Good morning, diners and travelers and art lovers and Anglophiles.
Yeah, there you go. We got something for both of you in those categories today.
All of you. Yes, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're bringing you today more of our experiences in London. Our new art enthusiast, Mr. Peter Rabbit here, talked to our listeners about the wonderful art shows we saw.
Well, London's always been, I guess, one of the world's great art capitals. There's really no doubt about that. And there's something going on almost all the time. And on this particular trip, we had a chance to go to some museums we've been to before who had wonderful new shows going on. I guess we've been to all of them before. They're a real highlight for those people who love Italian art. What century is Veronese, love?
It's 17th century.
What wonderful 17th century.
Well, no, I'm sorry, 16th century.
Okay, 16th century paintings by Veronese from around the world, not just the wonderful ones that are in the British Museum, the National Gallery's own collection. And some of them are really very large.
Yes.
Very large.
They don't even mention it, but the style is very clearly mannerist.
Okay.
So anyhow, I don't know where they got all this from, but all over, I guess.
Yeah, it's typical of the kind of collections they put together.
So it was a real revelation. I loved seeing them all together.
So they had some wonderful things from Italy and from museums totally, absolutely around the world. Now, just around the corner is a gallery many people miss, the National Portrait Gallery, substantially devoted to photography, although it does have a fine collection of painted portraits as well. A long-time favorite photographer of probably 5 decades, David Bailey, has an exhibition on there right now called Stardust. And when you look at who's on the wall, you know what Stardust means, because there are celebrities from every part of show business. Mick Jagger was a favorite. There's a portrait of a young Jack Nicholson looking totally ridiculously young, and characters over the years, including an icon of the middle 60s pop era, Marianne Faithfull, who is photographed as she was in the mid 1960s, and she's photographed now, and I'm surprised she was willing to have that shot taken.
Well, that was naked in that one.
That was a different one. Yes.
Well, I mean, he did do this thing where he invited people, just anybody passing by, to come into his studio and strip and get photographed naked. And I don't understand why they wanted to do that either. I mean, when you got to look at some of these people,
But either way, it's a remarkable collection, and it's a commentary.
And it shows you that Mick Jagger has never been good looking.
it's a snapshot.
He may be hot, but he's not good looking.
If you'll pardon my pun, it's a snapshot of 50 years of British celebrities captured in an iconic way by this fine photographer. At the Tate Modern, an absolutely wonderful collection that Anne just drooled over. Matisse, what's his first name? I always forget. You don't know Matisse's first name anymore either. But it's a collection of cutouts.
His name is Henri Matisse, but I'm not expecting you to keep throwing these questions at me.
Oh, I see. Well, just I'm trying to make sure you stay awake. But as those of you who are art lovers will know, when Matisse could no longer paint, that didn't stop him from producing great art. And this wonderful exhibition at the Tate Modern, just across the Millennium Bridge from St. Paul's Cathedral, a wonderful facility in and of itself, has a whole show dedicated to
his cutouts,
pieces. What he used to paint as pieces of paint, he now did with scissors and paper. And it's a truly remarkable exhibition. And the good news about that one is it's going on until September, because when we were there in late April, it was very busy. And then a stop we always make, although we didn't get to see Anne's favorite cat mummies this trip, there was an excellent, very historically oriented exhibit about the Vikings from, of course, Norway and Sweden, who raided around the world and substantially conquered my native land in the late single-digit centuries. And they have a wonderful reconstruction of a Viking ship.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Otherwise, I thought it was pretty boring.
a little bit of
they do have jewelry. I like that.
A little bit of history Viking is good. Jewelry. A little bit of history is good for you, and the British Museum is always a wonderful stop along the way.
And then,
of course, surprisingly, we did a little dining.
Now, what about Jean-Paul Gaultier?
Oh, I forgot that. I forgot about that one. Jean-Paul Gaultier at the Barbican Gallery, I guess, multifunction center in London, just around the backside of St. Paul's Cathedral. And neither of us had ever been there before.
No.
And hot on the heels of the wonderful Alexander McQueen.
Yeah, this show wasn't as good as Alexander McQueen, though.
We thought Jean-Paul Gaultier and his iconic styles adopted by people like Madonna and all other kinds of interesting people would be a good stop. And it was a good stop.
Yeah.
I think it would be fair to say it wasn't a great stop. Too many of those cone
bra things.
Right. And the fascinating thing.
I like the projections on the mannequins so that they looked like they were real people.
Yeah,
I think
for a while you thought they were.
I thought they were real people.
it was pretty frightening that they were going to be able to stand there for hours at a time. But it turned out that every face on a model had a little projector. That was projecting a series of eye movements. So that was kind of
and
fun.
And sound and murmuring, yep. And like talking to us and stuff.
Okay. Anyway.
Okay. So we did our art.
We did lots of art, and we would encourage you to do the same thing. And if you want details, these websites with information are very easy to find on the internet. And if you have trouble with that, they'll be in the description of today's program, so you can click straight through. When we come back, we'll go back to the dining theme of London. This time, what we call youngish British chefs. One of them at least allows that he's almost 40 years old, but he's not nearly ready to have his own place yet, but he's cooking up a storm. So each one an interesting little story. And then at the end of today's program, a surprise we won't tell you about until that comes along. So we'll be right back after this break. Don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and in addition to dining, I guess I shouldn't have used that word, addition, because it sounds too much like what I'm going to say, is we found our new favorite hotel, which is The Edition. And it's fine dining restaurant, Berner's Tavern, where even breakfast was a treat. It was fabulous. And one day I even had leftovers from the night before for lunch. Anyhow, we're really going to be talking to Phil Carmichael, who is the chef at this wonderful place, working under the superstar chef, Jason Atherton. And so let's listen to our conversation with him. Not Jason, but with... Well, we've been having many, many a fine meal at Berner's Tavern, and we're going to be talking to the chef responsible for all this, Phil Carmichael. Phil, it's good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, and it's been great cooking for you for the last sort of couple of days, and thank you for the comments.
Let's tell our listeners a little bit about your background. You've been essentially cooking your entire life, just about, right?
Yeah, I left school at sort of 16, straight into a kitchen, loved it, loved the atmosphere, loved sort of people, the camaraderie, and I'm sort of 37 now, and been doing it ever since. Kept getting told I was okay at it, so I sort of stuck at it. Here we are.
Now, you've worked also for a long time with Jason Atherton, who is the you're the executive chef and he is the corporate chef, more or less, right? Tell us a little bit what it's like working with him and Gordon Ramsay too.
Well, the fact that I've sort of been with Jason for sort of 10 years tells you everything about, what sort of man Jason is. The most driven chef I've ever met. Since he left Gordon 3 years ago, he's got, 16 restaurants worldwide already, and another sort of 3 this year. And he's supported me throughout much of my whole career. I've been with him 10 years, and He supported me, he sent me around the world. I've opened sort of 6 or 7 restaurants for him. Yeah, so it's great working for him. You know, we obviously met whilst we were working for Gordon Ramsay. Gordon gave Jason the freedom to sort of open restaurants and supported him in his sort of early career. So now it's, you know, passing that on to me and the other chefs in his sort of stable.
Well, I have two questions. One, the way you move around the world, it doesn't leave much for your personal life. And secondly, do you ever think it would be interesting to fly solo out from under the wing of?
When you sign up to be a chef, your sort of personal life pretty much goes out the window anyway. I mean, I'm very fortunate. My girlfriend's in the industry. She's a pastry chef, so, you know, she understands what we do and why we do it. And yeah, you know, there's always the thought of sort of, you know, flying solo, but it's, you know, I've got such a good relationship with Jason, and he knows what my sort of long-term dreams and aspirations are, which is to return to South Africa. It's, you know, he wants to sort of be my business partner in that project, so why would I turn that down? You know, it's, you know, he's supported me throughout my career. He's done everything he'd promised to do. So, I mean, you know, there's no intention of actually sort of going solo yet. No, not yet.
Now, you are by birth Welsh, and you wax rhapsodic about British ingredients, which I'd like for you to talk a little bit about. And then on top of that, why, if everything is so wonderful here, do you want to go to South Africa? I mean, people rave about South Africa, but I've never been. Tell us about, first, their involvement with the British ingredients, and secondly, your passion for South Africa.
Well, I mean, the British ingredients it's a simple one. It's we've got some of the most diverse products available to us, and in my opinion, they're some of the best products available anywhere in the world. Some of the best seafoods, crabs, scallops. You know, we export most of our crab and scallops to France, to Europe, because they're that good, they're that quality. Same with the meat, a massive improvement over the last 5-6 years of sort of husbandry techniques, and you know, the sort of free range grass-fed beef rearing. A lot of artisan producers have sprung up that literally they're passionate about what they do as we are about what we do, and that's when you meet a supplier like that, just can't help but, you know, you want to use it, you want to support them, you want to grow with these people, because they're doing an even not worse job, but, you know, an even thankless job than what we do. They never get to see the end product. They never get to see the customer eating their food. They're just doing what they're doing for the love of, you know, creating good food. And it's just full of those sort of producers, whether it's cheese, meat, fish, game. It's just all there.
So what about South Africa? You've been praising Cape Town, and you want to go live there? I don't know anything about the products or ingredients that they have there, but why are you in love with South Africa?
Simple answer is I fell in love with a South African. And she wants, you know, I mean, she eventually wants to go home. And I fell in love with the place. I sort of got off the plane when we landed there, and it just felt like home. It was a very, very strange sort of sensation. They're wonderful. There's a great foodie culture in Cape Town. It's not as developed as over here, but it's getting there. People want to eat. People want to know where their food comes from. People are genuinely interested in, you know, how their food's made. And there's, you know, some small artisan producers up. Obviously, you've got some of the best wines in the world there. Great fruit is grown there. Great meat's produced there. So, I mean, it's just wonderful, wonderful place. And the weather's nice.
Now, we know that your style is generally in the realm of modern British style, which is by very nature ingredient driven, and you are particularly ingredient driven. What are some of the I would say the signature dishes, some of the things that we had that we were in love with, were like this wonderful Jersey Royal potato with wild garlic soup. Talk to us about that. I love that.
That sort of sums up our philosophy about food in those sort of two lines. It's, you know, two of the most seasonal ingredients at the moment, which is Jersey Royal potatoes and wild garlic. You know, the wild garlic will be around for literally probably about another 2 weeks, so then we'll have to change it. You know, the Dorset snails, you know, it's a guy who sold up his fruit farm and bought literally 50 snails from a Frenchman and just started his own snail farm. It's, you know, it's purely seasonal. It's like green, it's fresh, it sums up what we're about. Yes, it's the ingredients that, you know, Jersey Raws won't be around, so then we'll have to change that.
There's one dish that we just have to talk about, although you probably better let us know how long it's going to be on the menu. This is salt marsh lamb from the Romney Marsh in Kent, I think, if I recall my geography correctly. Comes roasted somehow for a very long time, and then has peas, broad beans, and asparagus, and cabbage, and mint, which somehow all just happen to be in season right now. And they're all on one dish. And because the story of this is that not only did we enjoy it for dinner, not only did the people at the next table who we fed enjoy it, there was enough left over for lunch yesterday, which your staff kept for us. I think they were surprised. I think if you have a doggy bag, you take it home. Instead, our leftovers found a little corner in your refrigerator.
Yeah, I mean, again, yeah, the sort of, it's lamb season, new season lambs just sort of come in. And again, this is, you know, it just screams spring. You know, you've got fresh peas, you know, wood beans, the Wye Valley asparagus, which is, you know, the British asparagus season sort of runs from now until the end of May. Yeah, and again, it's just, you know, three or four things that are just bang in season that, you know, we can do very, very little to. You know, obviously we roast the lamb for sort of 16 hours, very, very low temperature. When you put all those sort of flavours together, it just works, and it just sort of springs, you know, just sort of screams spring to everyone. And it's become one of our most popular dishes. You know, we're selling sort of 14, 15 shoulders of lamb per night, so people love it.
It's a shame lambs only have two shoulders, right? Now, I understand that Chef Atherton has something of a wry sense of humour. So there's a dish on the menu that our waiter tried to persuade us to have, which is called Egg, Ham, and Peas. A deep-fried Clarence Court, must be a place, I guess, duck egg with crispy Cumbrian ham. That's nice. Mushy peas. I'm not so sure. Talk to us about that concept. I think that's in more than one dish on your menu. It's sort of like a memory of the past. So somehow reinvented on a plate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Jason's, you know, is rightly put out. He's from Yorkshire, and a lot of Jason's food is sort of tongue in cheek. He always like you said, sort of sense of humour to his food. So we don't take ourselves that seriously about it. So I mean, years ago, you'd have coming home from school, you'd have like egg, ham, and peas, as you know, which would be like probably boiled gammon, you know, some tinned mushy peas, you know, and a fried egg. That's what it'd be, and that's what you'd have. Yeah, so we've literally taken that flavour profile and just sort of jazzed it up, and you know, it's fresh garden peas that we crush with a little bit of mint, you know, season it with a little bit of malt vinegar. You know, it's a beautiful Clarence Court duck egg, which is a sort of free-range organic duck egg. All the ducks get to sort of live out freely, and you know, nothing in cages or anything like that. And then the Cumbrian ham is, you know, there's a couple of people up in Cumbria who started making ham, same sort of style as Parma ham from Italy. So instead of us buying in Parma ham from Italy, which everyone knows, we sort of source this, you know, ham which is exactly the same style, but it's British, from British pigs, you know, cured up in Cumbria. So, you know, it just brings that whole Britishness back into our food.
Now, you mentioned you would be in South Africa eventually, you would hope, and the wine resources there are extraordinary. What is your wine program like at Berner's Tavern?
Yeah, our wine program currently, you know, we've only been open sort of 6 months. It's focused primarily to this point on sort of old world wines, sort of Italy and sort of France. But we've just taken on a new sommelier. And he's got more sort of expertise in some new world wines, so we're going to be looking to sort of expand the list, you know, to incorporate some, you know, great South African wines, some more Californian wines, obviously Australian and New Zealand wines as well. We've got a great Wines by the Glass program, and we're trying it at Bond Street at the moment, but there's this new device out called a Coravan, which basically enables you to decant wine out of a bottle without letting any air in, so you can sort of do Chateau Petrus by the glass, and it'll keep it perfectly after you've sort of put one glass. So hopefully we're going to introduce that here as well.
How much is Bruce?
Up on the street, that's about 210 for 175ml glass.
Passing on that one.
And so you can have dinner at this restaurant
and you will enjoy it because it's fine dining. You'll have lunch at this restaurant. It will be the same. The amazing thing is that breakfast is a meal to really look forward to, because what's on the plate at breakfast time is just as good as everything else on the menu. And the most amazing thing being the color of the eggs that you fry or poach or whatever it is. How do you get them to be so vividly orange?
Well, again, all the eggs we use in the entire building are from Clarence Court. So, it's basically what they feed the hens on, the fact that they're sort of free range, the fact that they just get to go out and eat whatever they want, whenever they want. It's a very old sort of variety of hen that we use. It's called Legbar hen eggs for the breakfast, which naturally have a deep orange coloured yolk. It's just, again, back to their husbandry skills of, how they raise the hens, how they look after them. That just gives it, a depth of flavour that you just don't get in normal sort of eggs.
And we shouldn't forget, because black pudding is one of our favourite breakfast foods. And usually it's sort of, by the time it gets on your plate at breakfast time, it's kind of dried out. Now, you have a product from Stornoway, which is in the far north of Scotland somewhere, and it's really superior, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did a lot of taste tests prior to opening, and Stornoway black pudding is sort of famous in Britain as the best, one of the best black puddings that you can buy. And it is literally a tiny little village right up in the north of Scotland, and it's... Yeah, they say it's like the same recipe they've been using there for sort of hundreds of years. And it can only be called, sort of Stornoway black pudding if it comes from Stornoway. It's a superior product to a lot of else that's on the market.
This is known as a hot spot because it's new, of course, and because it's good. How difficult is it getting a reservation?
Only at the moment, sort of prime time slots, any night of the week, you're looking at July now. About two to three months sort of waiting list to get a sort of prime time slot. Lunches on a Monday you might be able to get in, but apart from that, no chance.
Now, do you have a better chance if you're staying in the hotel?
Of course. I mean, we always keep a few tables back for sort of in-house guests. They're here. We have to. We want them to. We're the only restaurant in the hotel, so where else are they going to eat?
Well, we thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's a Monday. Or is it? No, it's Tuesday today, right? Tuesday. I'm sure you have a busy day ahead, a busy week ahead. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for all the good comments about the food.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to go now to a restaurant that we've been to before, but with a totally different chef at the time. It was Adam Perry Lang the first time we went there, and he's been long gone. The restaurant is Barbacoa.
Yeah.
And it's actually a Jamie Oliver restaurant, but it's Hoos Vedat is wonderful. He's now one of my most favorite people. I just adore him. And he was formerly at Caxton Grill, but now he's cooking up a storm, and I probably had the largest pork chop I've ever seen in my life. But
I really
chowed down on the fries.
It was a family-sized pork chop. and Hoos talks about the meat plate, the daily special meat plate, and Peter ate his way through most of that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we did have those wonderful
beasts. We ate a lot, didn't we?
We ate a lot of stuff. Yes, indeed we did.
And it was all good.
But Hoos is such a really nice young man, admirably qualified to cook in a meat-oriented restaurant, and has lots of ideas you'll be very interested in, I'm sure.
I honestly, in our discussion, Hoos Vedat, kept running through my mind that you are probably the most all-around, best-prepared person I've ever talked to for your chefing. You've done everything, starting with your family's butchering. Just run quickly through the butchering, training, and all the different experiences you had. And if I think you're leaving one out, I'll jump in.
So, yeah, my family come from a line of butchers. I spent a lot of my days growing up in Smithfield Market butcher's market, and then going, you know, when I'm not at school, I was on summer holidays and weekends I was working in the shop, and started to develop a passion for meat. And then when I finished school, I went and worked in a butcher shop with my uncle, and customers were telling me, what do we do afterwards? So I wanted to learn what happens at the other end. So once we've boned and rolled a beautiful piece of lamb, how are we going to cook that afterwards? So I went to Brighton University and I'd done a culinary diploma, 3 years. And that's really when the passion for food started to develop. And then that coupled with the meat.
Your training was basically traditional classical French, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's when the colleges here in London, everything is kind of based on Escoffier's repertoire and very traditional kind of cooking style.
You know, the one thing we didn't mention, by the way, is that where you are now and where we are and what we're going to do here is we're at Barbacoa, which is one of Jamie Oliver's concepts. We've been here before, but with a different chef.
And it's no surprise, I guess, that Hoos is here, because if this restaurant stands for one thing, it stands for meat.
So you traveled a lot. Some of the experiences you had were in Australia, New Zealand. Tell us about your experiences. You're married to a Spanish woman. Your experiences in the south of Spain, because that was very interesting.
So when I ended up being in a restaurant in San Pedro, which is near Marbella in the south of Spain. It was a small neighborhood restaurant. It was my first position as head chef. It was an Italian restaurant. My team were all Italian and spoke Spanish, and I didn't speak Italian or Spanish. So it was a very interesting time. But I guess we all spoke the language of food. The chef who was making pasta every day by hand, I learned so much from him. He learned so much from me, and it was just a great time. We were producing great food, happy food, food with love. We used to go to the markets. We used to pick up the fresh fish. The menu used to change daily. We did have an a la carte menu, but the guests were never, they said they didn't want the a la carte menu. Just tell us what we were eating. Because it was a neighborhood restaurant, people used to come 3-4 times a week. And we developed that, and it was they trusted me and how and the restaurant and how we cooked, and that was my first real, again, the passion started to grow more and more.
It must have been difficult to leave that, but you wanted to develop further and to jump into large scale dining. Is that it, when you were working in hotels and opening hotels?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think it's a natural kind of progression. It was, you know, I was there for a couple of years. It was a beautiful time. But, you know, I wanted something bigger and better and more challenging in terms of the size of the brigade and what I can achieve. And London is my home, and I wanted to see what that was going to explore. I wasn't ever going to be a chef who always cooked like Mediterranean and Italian food. I wanted to understand a little bit more about myself and what kind of food I want to cook moving forward.
Well, you did your banquets at various hotels, so you got the volume thing. What led you to your current interest in, is it modern British?
For me, food is king, I should say, is like it's an art, and there's very many forms of expression of those dishes. However, people that juice ingredients, i.e. people that produce cheeses, produce charcuterie, grow parsley, rear lambs, if all of those people do what they do with passion, it makes our life as a chef much easier, because we have to do little after that, but treat it with respect and integrity. So I use the analogy that I'm more of a DJ than a producer, because DJs select good songs that are already made, and me as a chef, I select great ingredients and just treat them with respect and enhance their flavor, rather than try to modify that, and respecting the producers. And that's the kind of, if that is what modern British is, then it's modern British. I don't actually know what is modern British, really.
Nobody understands half of these terms, I don't think. But it's interesting to me that Barbacoa is a barbecue concept. And I would think that that is a much more restrictive concept than what you're describing. How can you find room for creativity and talk to us about some of these menu items that you do that's not just straight barbecue?
For me, the barbacoa is a celebration of cooking techniques that involve fire and wood. Now, yes, there is a big American influence in barbecue, as in your traditional pork butts and briskets, and that does exist. But I like to think that barbacoa is not just about that. We have various bits of kit, so the smoker being one of them. We also have a tandoor oven, which is from India. We have an Argentinian grill, which is obviously from InDesign. We have a big green, well, that's a new one actually, a new toy that we're playing with. We have Rabata grills, we have wood ovens, and all of these things are fired with wood and charcoal, which for me barbecue is international. Everyone barbecues everywhere in the world. And for me it's about, you know, using those travels and influences which are global to see how people do cook outdoors using wood and fire. And I've just started here really in terms of the exploration of it, but I mean the possibilities are endless, you know, from braai in South Africa to smoking from Tennessee to tandoor in India. You know, we've only just really started to explore it. Like one of the dishes is a tandoori prawns. Now, prawns lends itself to a tandoor oven because the intense heat kind of creates a crust on the outside but doesn't overcook on the inside because there's no direct heat. And for me, that technique is Indian in origin. So I wanted to give the dish an origin in India. So we've got that with a lime pickle yogurt and a traditional tandoori kind of garnish is like pickled red onions and tomatoes. And we've done a little twist on that. We've smoked the tomatoes. We've put some garlic chips in there just for a bit of texture. And we smoke it afterwards. Now, that after it's cooked, then we smoke it. So it's a quick 10-second smoke once it's heated. So we smoke it on the plate. And that just gives it the last dimension that, you know, of flavor to the dish. And I think it's a well-balanced dish. It's selling really well. But, like, you know, that's a dish which is influenced by, come from me and from you know, Indian influence.
Well, I mean, this is a very sophisticated, when we say barbecue, you don't expect all the sophistication, but this indeed is sophisticated. How about, can you name a couple other dishes and talk us through them? Because it's so interesting to hear your take on them.
One of another dish that I quite like here that we have, which isn't currently on the menu, but we do sell it as a special, is we have a lot of interaction with our butchers here at the restaurant, because we dry age all our own beef. We source all our own cows. And so the dialogue between the chef and the butcher happens on a daily basis, which the diner doesn't always get to see. So my idea of how I could bring that to the table was we developed a butcher's board. So it's a daily, like, changing cuts of meat. It enables him to utilize the whole carcass, and it gives us the challenge of pairing up different cuts of meat with different things. And so, like, today's, for example, butcher's cut board, it's got a skirt steak, which is it's got a churrasco marinade, which is its typical South American. It's marinated because it's got of the texture. We marinate that overnight, and it's got in garlic and parsley. And then we give that an aggressive heat on the Rabata, so it chars on the outside, but it still stays tender in the middle. That's one component of the dish. And I just serve that with a little bit of rocket with lemon juice on there, just to give that cut through that char and give it that little zing. Then in the middle today, we've got a picanha, which is it's from the rump, but it's only the top cap of the rump, which is, it's very gamey, and it's, we age our rump steaks. So, like we're currently at, you know, optimum is between 5 and 7 weeks. I think we're at about around 6 weeks now, which is, so the picanha, we take it off and we use that in the middle there. So it's got an earthy kind of gamey kind of flavor to it. So I pair that with some mushrooms that we cook over the embers. Whatever's around at the time. At the moment, we're using king oysters. And then on the end today, we've got a bit of fillet. So it's a fillet steak. So, and with some freshly grated horseradish over the top. So it's like a journey or a taster. So you're going from a steak which has got a lot of flavor and a lot of texture to the steak in the middle, which has got earthy notes to it and age notes to it. And it's really a steak lover's steak in the middle. And then you've got a fillet steak on the end, which is it's the most tender cut. And we just spike that with a little bit of horseradish just to give it a little kick.
And of course, we haven't talked about the duck fat fries or any of the other sides, which are all very interesting and well conceived. The beetroot salad, which I'm hoping to try.
Yeah, that's coal roasted. Really?
The beetroot salad is we use quite a few different types of beetroots, and so let's use different techniques on them. So what we do is we the golden beetroot, we bury it in a pit. So once at the end of the night, once the embers are starting to go down, before we go home, we stick just beetroot as it is. No tricks to it at all. Just the whole beetroot stay on there, and they get turned over halfway through. But then in the morning when the chef comes, it's cooked perfectly, and it's actually burnt on the outside and charred. And what we do is we just break it off and peel it off. You don't get much yield to it. Unfortunately, there's quite a bit of waste. But what you do get in the middle is this unbelievably amazing, real, earthy kind of char flavor that you wouldn't be able to get in any other kitchen, really, because unless you have a lot of a pit.
Well, I can't wait to try some of these. And I think we ought to mention that the space itself is very airy, sunny, contemporary, sleek, well designed, and it's a place where people smartly dressed are seen. I wanted to ask you, I'm looking at a wall here of different kinds of wood, I believe. Some of them are in jars as though they're pickling. I'm curious. And then next to that, is that charcoal? Well, tell me what these pieces of wood are pickling in.
The wood, we use wood from the UK, and we're experimenting currently with different types of wood. So for our prawns, for example, we're using sweet chestnut. We're using oak for our pulled pork. And we've got a dish which is coming onto the new menu, which is going to be using beech wood. And that's going to be a duck dish. So what we do is we cure the duck. We put the duck directly onto the wood, onto a plank, a beech plank. And then the plank goes directly onto the coal, onto the embers. So as the wood starts to burn, it lets off an amazing kind of flavor that then penetrates the duck, and that's the starter that we're going to serve. So these are the different types of wood species. The things that are actually going on in there is that's the bar team. There's some vanilla in there, there's some horseradish in there, there's some cinnamon infused infusion going on. They're vodkas. Okay, they're actually vodkas. The bar team are doing that.
Well, this is exciting.
Well, it's really funny. We got all this way. We forgot to mention that there's this guy who's sort of behind this concept, whose first name is Jamie. In 30 seconds or less, what's it like to work for somebody who's a rather outstanding personality, shall we say?
I mean, Jamie is hugely, hugely passionate about food and everything to do with food. He's completely hands-on. If he was his way, he'd be constantly in the kitchen with us. It's tough for him. He's a busy man, but we do have a lot of dialogue via text and via emails, and he comes in to taste when we've got something new that is going to go on the menu. He will add a Jamie tweak to it if he sees fit. But Jamie's just a wonderful, caring, great family man, great cook. and all round good guys. It's a joy to work for someone who is so passionate about what he does.
Well, I thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and I look forward to sampling your wares, as they say. And I think that, as I said, it's amazing all the preparation that you've brought to this job. So it has to be 10 cuts above what anybody else would possibly do with barbecue and the accompaniments of barbecue, and much more profound in concept than you'd think by the title. Anyhow, thank you very much, Huth.
One of the interesting things we discovered in our interview with Huth is that his previous posting was at the St. Ermin's Hotel, and he actually hired and mentored, I guess, the chef who's going to be coming up after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Turned out to be a really interesting story that Huth Vedat at Barbacoa had previously, last posting, had been at the Caxton Grill, which he opened for the owners of the St. Ermin's Hotel. And Adam,
it was his concept, actually.
Yes.
Grill, and to bring in that Jasper
Grill and all of the above. And he also hired two executive sous chefs, I guess you would call them. And they sort of took over running the kitchen after Huth left. And Adam Hendling is the restaurant chef there now, and because we took the opportunity to talk to him.
Now, we ate at Caxton Grill and interviewed the chef last year in the St. Ermin's Hotel. But guess what? We actually have a new chef now, and we're going to be sampling his food. And I want to introduce you to Adam Hendling, who's now the head chef at Caxton Grill, who wins every award that's been created. Adam, tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, why are you a chef? Why are you here? You were born in Scotland. You lived in Germany. You have a very cosmopolitan influence in your life. Just talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think I became a chef because I had a good traveling upbringing as a child. Again, living in Germany and different places. To be fair, every 2 years we'd move around. So experience, very family, food-orientated family. In doing so, I was the one that would be under my mother's table helping her while all my brothers and sisters were actually studying. I'm probably the only one like my mother. The rest are like my father. And then it was just from the age of 15 I realized, no, I wanted to be a chef. I didn't want to stay on at school anymore. And I managed to get the first ever apprenticeship in Glen Eagles Hotel, which was one of the best in the hotels in the world at that time. And 15 years old, I couldn't say no to an opportunity like that. And then I did a 3-year apprenticeship.
Now, I mean, you've done cruise ships. Do you travel for these competitions that you're in as well?
Yeah, I did a cruise ship for one stint, purely just to make my CV a little bit more better. I've always been fine dining in small restaurants. I wanted to do the best of large numbers, and to be part of the Crystal cruise ships and do one stint there, it was just an incredible one. It definitely completely different to any restaurant that I've ever worked in. And yeah, I do love to travel. Any opportunity I do, I'm away to Asia, Japan, China, all that kind of stuff. I love all that influence. So yeah, I when I have a holiday, I don't stay in Europe. I go straight out.
Yes, you were talking about almost working in Melbourne, but you decided to travel the world, and that's it. So you have all these influences. Do they show up in your cooking?
All of my menus, they have a massive influence. Not a massive, but they have the smart influences that I've learned in Japan, Southeast Asia, them kind of countries. And I'm a very classically trained chef. You know, I'm a firm believer you need to know them before you can play around with anything else. So all my dishes are classically designed, classically structured, the same, that foundation with a modern twist. Well, not modern, I hate the word twist, modern execution for ease of service and consistency, really, using ingredients from Asia, predominantly Japan. So yeah, quite a bizarre menu, but it actually works together. It works well together, I think.
Well, you're talking about this bizarre menu. Now, this is not the one that I'm looking at right now. You were in the process. Now you're about to leap into a brand new menu. Tell us what you mean when you tell me.
Yeah, the current menu is very much food orientated. You know, it's delicious food, done well. The new menu that I'm relaunching, I'm removing the Jasper grill, so it's not going to be a grill anymore. Yeah, I'm stripping everything back and really concentrating on purity of flavors. Now, in doing so, the Asian influence is dramatically higher than what I'm currently doing. I think every single dish will contain, not predominantly, but you will definitely know it's there. Using British main ingredients, you know, all the proteins, things like that. And it's going to be more fun, you know, like little donuts, but filled with crab. You know, there's a dish on the menu called beetroot, and more beetroot, which is what it sounds. There is loads of different types of beetroot in this tiny, tiny little thing. But when you eat it, it is just so refreshing, so sharp, so sweet, so everything what beetroot should be in one tiny little thing. And I'm going to design it so not so much tasting menus, take away the stiff service, the stiff food, the precision. It's going to be laid back, still fine dining, but you want people to have like four or five dishes. They're going to be quite small, but every single one completely different to the last one. And it'll be predominantly flavor, not presentation. It's going to be look natural, unponcified now, and just natural, honest, great food. That's the plan.
Are you going to put steak frites on the menu?
No. There'll be no steak frites or anything like that on the menu at all.
Well, specifically, are we going to change or taste any of these, the new dishes tonight?
We're in the middle of developing the dishes. They should go on in about 2 weeks, so there's a lot of things needing to be worked. I never launch a menu that the entire kitchen hasn't done 1 month's worth of solid practicing, solid playing, testing them out, as well as figuring the faults and trying to improve. So sadly, not tonight, there won't be anything.
So what's your favorite ingredient, or what is your new favorite ingredient?
My favorite ingredient... I'm a massive scallop man. I'm a massive fish man, to be honest. I prefer fish than meat. Very bizarre for this type of restaurant, which was the other way around when I first started. Well, I think my favorite ingredient, that's a hard question to ask a chef, I think. We love everything. I can tell you I don't like coffee, but when it comes to favorite ingredients, it's quite hard to pick one.
No, you just got this award. Let's back up. Last time we were here, we did not talk to you because you were competing on a BBC Two for MasterChef, which is pretty much the same format, you said. And then you also got this ACORD award in 2013, and you just got another one. Is there some sort of adrenaline rush you get with these competitions?
Yeah, every time I'm doing a competition, I always say, that's it. It's the last competition. I'm too stressed. It's you know, it takes over my entire life. And then as soon as it's done, I get bored and I want to do another one. I think competitions are a great way of figuring out your strongest points and your weakest points extremely quickly, because the people judging it are the people you idolize, and they won't be shy when they come to tell you there's mistakes. And it just, I think they better a chef. Because it makes you stand on your feet. So, for instance, a service time, and you get customers wanting or not agreeing with what's on the menu, you think on your feet, and you can produce the same standard of dish using things that aren't on the menu. That sort of thing. So I think when it comes to running a restaurant or being confident in your own abilities as a chef, I think competitions are a fantastic way to push you out that door.
You mentioned that people you admire. Could you name just a few of these people? Who are the people that you really admire and emulate, and who have been some of your major mentors?
When it comes to idolizing chefs, the British chefs at the moment, they are some of the best. They are fantastic. And Sat Bains, one, is an incredible chef. You know, he's actually very inspiration of his Asian influences in his dishes. I want to be something like that in like 20 years' time. I think the stuff he does is phenomenal. And then we've got like the Tom Akins, where I idolized as a youngster. When I was young, I did stages in his restaurant twice, and I loved everything about his food.
He never threw anything at you or burned you?
I was young then. I could easily dodge everything. But yeah, it was definitely a strict kitchen. But he's probably one of the very few chefs that can actually produce a dish using 55,000 ingredients and get away with it. One of my biggest inspirations as well is obviously Massimo in Italy. His philosophy of food is just mental. The guy is a child in a man's body, but he is a genius at that as well. And he is one of a kind.
Well, that gives me, just from the people you named, it gives me some idea of your directions. And I'm sorry I won't be able to taste it. Then I guess we'll have to come back and do whenever this new menu comes on. And when would that be?
It should come on in about, I think, the 5th is a Monday, so 7 days after that, the 12th, yeah.
We'll be gone by then, but next trip. Thank you so much, and looking forward to how you develop and where you go from here. Adam, you were, my copy here says you were crowned. Ah, did they give you a crown? Anyhow, 2014 British Culinary Federation Chef of the Year. That just happened this April. Now, some of these new dishes are in that category of what did you enter them a competition or is that what happened? Okay, and so those are really formed dishes. They haven't been put on the menus yet, but they're formed. Could you just talk us through some of that to get some an idea of your creativity, your thought process?
Yeah, there's one starter which it seemed to have had a lot of people talking because it was a little bit bizarre, which is we do a salmon which is being cured in fennel pollen. So very, very full. Fennel pollen and lemon. And then cooked again in the water bath. So it's precise cooking in olive oil. And then it's served with peas. Peas, dill, and apple. Sounds very bizarre, but it's a pea panna cotta with little jasmine pickled apples covered in dill powder. There's dehydrated dill and a sweet and sour wasabi kind of thing, which is a puree of some sort. But it's green, it's beautiful, it's so vibrant, and it brings the dish alive. Again, that's quite a classical dish, but there's also another starter where you can go scallops, which is we're doing a scallop and a ponzu with braised shallots and crispy onions. It kind of goes from one extreme to the next, but the idea is each dish is radically different. So the menu's rather small dishes, but designed to have, you know, quite a lot. Again, 4, 5, 6 dishes per person, and you can kind of go through like a little journey of, not my life, because I think that's too cliche kind of thing, of my inspirations, of what I like to eat, and like that. And then like shooting over to the mains, we have a lamb dish, which is a neck of lamb, and it's cured in juniper for like 3 days. So very floral. And then it's served with lots of different types of cauliflower, burnt cauliflower, Romanesque cauliflower, pickled cauliflower. And it's served with cockles, you know, a crazy thing, a classic combination of lamb and anchovies kind of thing. And then you go down a beef route, which is a little bit more classical, which is beef with parmesan custard, burnt onions and pickled girolles with wild garlic. It's a journey through, again, British, moving away, back and forth, etc., etc. And we're in London, you know, there's so many different varieties of restaurants. So this is one that kind of not has them all, because I don't like that, just everything I like to eat. And what I love, me on a plate.
Okay, so we promised you a surprise at the end of the program. Sweetheart, do you want to do the surprise?
Well, no. I mean, anybody who knows me knows I'm crazy about bees. And last year when we were staying at this hotel. The St. Ermans Hotel, I noticed on one of the bridges connecting the two different structures, there were beehives. And I encountered on that little, one of my daily treks past the beehives, the beekeeper, a real person who has a company. And this is this year we thought in advance to set up an interview with Camilla, who is the beekeeper for the St. Ermans and a bunch of other places in London too. So listen, she knows so much
about bees. And bees are very surprising, you'll find. So hang in there and listen, as we say sometimes. Hang in and listen, you might learn something. And this will be a great wrap-up for today's program.
Last year, at this exact same hotel, the St. Ermans Hotel, I ran into Camilla Goddard, who is, of all things, a beekeeper. I mean, not just a general little small beekeeper. She is a corporate beekeeper. And we talked and we chatted, but this is the first chance we had to actually get her recorded to talk about her beekeeping activities. Now, you do how many bees here, Camilla, and how many other hives do you manage? And how long have you been doing it? And how did you come to do this?
I keep about 6 hives here at St. Ermin's and then another 50-odd hives all over town in London for universities, schools, all over the place, and for different businesses and organisations. And I've been doing it for about 9 years. It started off as a hobby, and then people started asking me to look after bees for them. They wanted the honey. And I was interested in keeping bees and collecting swarms because people were worried about bees dying out. So that's kind of how I got into it. But I love it. It's a great thing to do.
Well, I want to mention at this point that this hotel I know uses a lot of the honey product in various things, in teas and so forth in the hotel. You touched on something that was a little worrisome, this colony collapse disorder, which is rampant in the United States. Here, you say it's not quite as bad, and it seems to be mitigating this year, huh?
Last year, a lot of colonies died out because of the very long winter. It was the weather. And then there's also varroa mite, which is endemic in all colonies, undermines the strength of the colonies. So beekeepers are always trying to get varroa mite levels down in their colonies. But it's not in the same sort of level as America has had. But it's still, we're worried about the lack of, you know, wildflower meadows, foraging sources and that kind of thing. So it's an ongoing kind of concern. But fortunately, this year has been amazing. We've had a lovely warm spring. The swarms already at this time of year, which is hasn't been like that for a long time. And you're seeing the bees doing a joy dance, you know, in the hive, which is just like a shivering excitement, you know, which is beautiful to see.
Now, you were talking about this joy dance. Talk about that. I mean, how do they, what did you call it? Not democracy or how they made decisions, decision making. Tell us about that in the hives.
Well, there's at least 3 types of dances with bees. So you have a waggle dance, which is how they know, how they show each other where and in what direction a good source of pollen and nectar is to be found. So they come back and they do a little dance. And it relates to the sun, and they do it on the surface of the wax frame, the foundation, and they dance north and around in a circle of 8, and then north again if the source is in the direction of the north or towards the sun. And then they might change the direction depending on the angle away from the sun. And then other bees all sit around watching it, and they might try a bit of the nectar out and see if they like it. And then they'll go and fly off and try it out. So that's a waggle dance. Then you have a kind of joy dance, which is just a general kind of shaky kind of excitement, which is like on a really hot day, things are going really well, lots of nectar coming in. And then the one we were talking about earlier is like this democratic process they have, which is when a colony swarms, the old queen goes out, and they make new queens inside by feeding them royal jelly. That's why it's called royal jelly. And they have these sort of princesses that hatch out and sort of fight to the death, and one of them becomes a new queen. Meantime, you've got the queen hanging in a tree with lots of other workers hanging around her. They all settle around the queen, and then they send off scouts all around the area. And the scouts come back, and if they particularly like a spot, might be a chimney pot or something like that, they come back and they do a little dance showing the direction and the distance. And then other bees watch it, and if they like it, they carry on and they fly off and check out the site. And then gradually you kind of have a dance off, and the most popular kind of dance is the one that they go for. And that's how the honeybee democracy idea that people have talked about in books recently works. You know, it really is. They decide by a kind of group majority thinking. And then hopefully it works out for them.
It's a little bit like Dancing with the Stars or Strictly Ballroom, as they describe it in this country. Now, how did you get the bees to come to the St. Ermin's Hotel? I mean, how did you influence them to come here? Did you bribe the scouts, or did you do a dance, or what did you do?
What happens normally is you don't get a swarm. You have something called nucleus colonies that come on four frames, which has the queen already there, and maybe 5,000 workers. So they're sort of ready to go, and you just slot them into the hive. But if you get a swarm off a tree, you attract them into a box using a bit of drawn honeycomb. They like the smell of it. And it's a lot easier than going to find a new house somewhere. So they kind of sort of walk their way down. Once the queen's gone in, they generally all follow in. And then if you can, you kind of water the tree a bit and get rid of the scent of the queen so they don't keep going back to that site.
Now, I was saying to you that, that so many people are keeping bees in the United States these days. And a lot of times they're on rooftops of in skyscrapers in major cities like New York. And the big problem that's developing is there's not enough food sources available. The balance is off for the bees.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of interest in beekeeping over the last couple of years, and a lot of people have taken it up. In England, things have kind of balanced out because there was a lot of losses last year. It was about something like a third of UK colonies died out because of the bad weather. So that's kind of evened things up a bit. And now what's happened, it's not so many individuals, it's more like large organisations like schools that are really interested in teaching young people how to look after bees. So, and I'm really pleased to see that, you know, they're seeing it as more sustainable. And also another change is people are not just keeping bees, but they're also planting for bees. And that's just as important.
We can't overemphasise the significance of bees to production of food with pollination. In the States, of course, the people who are beekeepers move the hives around all the orchards. And do they do that here?
Out in the country, they'll take them out to places like Dartmoor for the heather, and Scotland as well. You know, they take them up for the heather. But in London, actually, we have about, three or four large, they call them flows, which is when there's a particular blossom coming out. And the bees respond to that, and that's when they suddenly have a big rush of nectar gathering, and they dry it out by night using their wings, and they when it's ready and the water content's gone down, it becomes honey, and that's when they seal it. So you have in London, in Greenwich actually, there's a lovely honey, which is chestnut honey from the park, because there's all the chestnut trees in the park. You get a lot of lime tree honey. And trees are so in London, people don't realise. They think it's all about planting lavender, but actually trees, are really, significant. And also privet hedges. Everybody's got these little privet hedges around their, front garden. They're being used by bees. So don't trim your privet hedges because they use them.
But I meant they move bees around to pollinate, like apples and...
Not in London. No, people don't really use that. Apparently, more parks are now seeing it as an important source of pollination, and people are connecting the two. And certainly I've had bees on allotment sites, and people have noticed their raspberries or their runner beans doing better and that kind of thing. And you've got loads of allotments in London.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time, because I understand that you have to go tend a swarm. You have a swarm somewhere that you have to... take care of or do whatever you're going to do with it. But listeners, I mean, the honey you can find being used in the kitchen here at St. Ermin's Hotel, you'll find chocolate bees, little honey bees and chocolate on your pillow at night, which thrilled me and my grandchildren so much. Peter liked it too. Anyhow, thank you and keep up the good work. And I'm going to go, we just got here today, but I'm going to go and say hello to the bees. You can see, right? And I'll see you there.
Exactly. It's rather curious. This is a rather special honey that you get at the St. Ermin's, because it's got some royal blood in it. But there's also something else going on that says this is really good honey. Tell us about that.
We had the honey from St. Ermin's analysed, and it's a bit similar to forensics where they find pollen, and they can track where people have been. So we have a look at the honey to see the contents and where the bees have been. And what happened is we found things, there was about 50 different sources, flower sources, many of which were trees, but also things like water lily. So they must be going to James Park, and Buckingham Palace is around the corner. I think they've got, a royal interest there too. So we're really excited to see what they're doing. And the other thing as well, bees in London, they go along the train tracks. So they're using those as pathways for nectar. and for pollen. So brambles, you know, fireweed, all that sort of stuff. For them, it's perfect.
So from Matisse cutouts and Vikings to bees, a little bit of dining in between. We hope you've enjoyed the journey through today's program, and we'll be hoping that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.